Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. The Ohio primary is 2 weeks away, so Democrats and Republicans are making their final pitches to voters. The gubernatorial rivalries are of particular note. On the Democratic side, Dennis Kucinich is under fire for sympathies for Syria's dictator. On the Republican side, Mike DeWine continues to attack rival Mary Taylor as a phony conservative, his words, and two-faced, again, his words. Here to sort through all the rhetoric and get to the facts, such as they are, is our panel of reporters, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Jesse Balmert. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
And Ohio Republic Radio State House News Bureau reporter, Joe Ingles. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
And Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs editor, Daryl Rowland. Welcome as always, Daryl.
The first Ann Fisher show of the year where I've not had to wear a coat. Fantastic.
Oh, I know it. I know.
That's nice. It is nice.
Can we just talk about the weather and the new baby in Britain right now? Could we just...
I wish. But then babies cry and do other bad stuff, so we might as well, too.
And it is going to rain later today.
Well, so there you go.
Yeah, you're going to jinx us.
That was your 15 seconds of good news, folks. Sorry.
So much optimism and then just backsliding,
yeah.
That's what happens when you get political reporters together.
Yes, exactly. You can't go for long. But yay you for not having to wear a jacket. Why, though? You know, for people who only have a glance, you know, they understand that there's a civil war in Syria. What in the world does Bashar al-Assad have to do with Dennis Kucinich?
Well, and
riddle me that.
Dennis Kucinich and, frankly, one of the other rivals in, in the race, Bill O'Neill, the former Supreme Court justice, say nothing. And Mr. Kucinich told one of our reporters, my colleague Marty Schladen, that the only Damascus I'm worried about is Damascus, Ohio. So it comes down to a question of does it matter to voters? And it goes to character issues. It goes to judgment issues. Dennis Kucinich has always had this streak to him that dare I say, as some people sort of kind of a wacky streak, shall we say?
Loose cannon-ish?
Yeah. And there's, you know, he toes the straight progressive line fairly well. But there's this odd backdrop of dalliances with some very radical people. He has, first of all, he filed a financial disclosure statement saying he got, you know, $37,000 for speeches. The Ethics Commission chairman says, not good enough, you got to tell us, you got to itemize. And it turns out that one of those was $20,000 from this group who has ties to Assad, again, the dictator in Syria. And Dennis Kucinich says, hey, it was a peace conference, whatever. But these are very radical folks. Dennis will not tell us, nor will his campaign people, whether he's gotten additional money to speak at other events, sympathetic with the pro-Syrian government. And I should say that this group is considered radical because they're anti-U.S. Well, they say, get out of, we want to get, U.S. gets out of Syria. And Russia is the good guys. And again, this comes from Dennis has appeared on Russia Today, on RT.com, a Russian news network. And not just Russian. These are Kremlin-backed. So they are state-sponsored, if you will.
This group, though, members or officers of the group think that the 9/11 attacks were not acts of terrorism but controlled demolitions. They're pretty out there. This isn't—
Right. That's the head of this group that, that gave— Mr. Kucinich, former Congressman Kucinich, the funding. And, yeah, one of our guys, we talked to the treasurer, and he says he doesn't care if Assad is a dictator or not. It's not up to us to decide if people in Syria should have have the right to vote or not. And all these chemical attacks are, you know, I don't know, are fiction or something like that. So these are the folks that Dennis Kucinich is hanging around with, getting money from. And it's not like that fact was known afterwards. He knew that going in, who he's associating with. So again, if you don't think that's relevant, fine. That's your right as a voter. If you think it's it reflects on his judgment or, again, on his character, then plug that in.
He did not immediately report this on his financial disclosure forms. Joe Ingles, is there a sense that this hurts him with voters and that's something to worry about?
Well, yeah, I think that this does have the capacity to hurt him with voters because I shouldn't say most. I don't know. I think most people I know know that Syria is, you know, has issues and that Assad is a bad guy and he, you know, uses chemical agents on his people and that, you know, we hear that narrative all the time. Uh-huh. Actually, it's not a narrative. We see the facts on the television set every day. So we kind of know that that's not the people we want to be allied with in this country. And that's how much we know. We don't, you know, no one, I don't know a lot of people who are Syria experts. So where is the voter's mind? That's what you're asking. And the voter is probably, they probably have a negative association with Assad in Syria, but they probably don't know enough about it to be able to distinguish, you know, what Denis Kucinich has actually done and how this works into the piece. And when they have other viable candidates out there that they might be vacillating between one or the other, this could be just enough to push one of them over to a different candidate.
Because it's making them question. They're not exactly sure what, but they're questioning, and that's not.
Right.
You know, do we expect Richard Cordray to run negative ads pointing this stuff out?
I believe both Rich Cordray and Joe Schiavone, the state senator who's also running, have said, you know, this is a problem. They're not pointing to Kucinich's speech as a positive for Kucinich's campaign. So I'm not sure if they are going to run attack ads specifically on this, but I wouldn't be surprised. It's definitely something they've pointed out and tried to distance themselves from, saying, you know, we aren't the ones meeting with the Syrian president Assad. We aren't the ones going to his speeches that were paid for by groups that are sympathetic to him. So this is a contrast that at least two of the candidates are trying to make with themselves and Mr. Kucinich.
Yeah.
And you know, the big picture is it was appearing that Denis Kucinich had a real shot at this nomination. The Cleveland Plain Dealer endorsed him over Rich Cordray and the other Democrats in the race. He was, you know, the man is a publicity machine, and he's a very hard worker. He's been all over the state. Mm-hmm. To his credit, he perhaps has the most detailed proposals of issues. Look on his website and compare it to the others, although Joe Schiavone has some good details on some of his economic plans as well. And this whole gun issue that has been his, you know, he's lived and breathed it, and mainly because he can, you know, stick it up Cordray's nose and you know, Rich Cordray, the A-rated NRA candidate, you know, I'm Denis Kucinich. I'm proud to wear that F on my lapel. It's a good year for that. So if that was making momentum, and again, like Joe, just sort of sitting here in Columbus, it's credible to think it was. That could have been blunted by this past week. Because something like this, it's like when Hillary talked about the deplorables. It's like, sometimes something happens on the campaign trail that's done or said. It's, you know, this just certifies what I always was worried about all along, that, you know, this is how Hillary thought all along, or this is how, you know, sort of confirms that whack factor, to put it bluntly, with Denis Kucinich.
Yeah, I know Democrats have been a little concerned with Kucinich just because he had met with the president Assad previously. He also said some complimentary things about President Donald Trump's inaugural address in a tweet, which has since been removed. And just these kind of sentiments. He also was a commentator on Fox News. Certain things that don't sit well with Democrats, but are those things going to overwhelm, you know, the gun issue or so forth with voters? It's hard to tell right now, but the recent news that he was paid this $20,000 for a speech really is in line with those concerns that some Democrats have had all along.
I think the interesting thing here, and the thing that I'm going to be watching on election night, is how Joe Schiavone does. Because if you look at the platforms, a lot of the things that that Democrats like about Kucinich, they also like about Schiavone. And if they see Schiavone as the alternative, you know, I'll go ahead and vote for him. That will show up on election night. And that's interesting at best. And, you know, Schiavone could go on to have, you know, even if he doesn't win the contest, he could go on to have a very long career in Ohio. He's been a state senator, been in the legislature.
Still young.
Yeah, still young.
Yeah. You know, there was another shooting over the weekend in Nashville. A gunman with an AR-15, that's an assault-style weapon, shot and killed four people before another man grabbed the gun away from him. This brings the issue of the assault weapons back to the fore again, not like a school shooting would, but certainly does. It can't be good news for Rich Cordray that this has happened, but I figure there's going to be a lot more of this before the election's done, sadly. does every single one of these events have some kind of impact on his candidacy, Darrell Rowland, given his A rating with the NRA?
Well, two things. I think it's going to have – I mean, if you say it's going to have a negative impact, I think that's not going to be for the next 2 weeks, you know, until the primary. Because I think the tables might flip a little bit, despite the contrast with you know, presumed Republican nominee DeWine, Attorney General. I think it might benefit Cordray a little bit more. As odd as that seems, the gun issue may be kind of neutralized in the fall election. You know, the gun folks that I know still don't care for DeWine, even though he's maybe made right on some issues. He certainly pushed every concealed carry bill that's been out there and enforcement along those lines. And Rich Cordray, I think they've become more suspicious of him. And he has backed off a little bit from some of those stances that got him that the infamous A rating. And, you know, that was back in 2010. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't rate the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, to my knowledge. So it's been a while since Rich has gotten his grade card from the NRA. So we'll see. So I don't know. It is in some ways a shooting at a Tennessee Waffle House. Does that affect the Ohio governor's race? Maybe a little. But you're right. It keeps the gun issues. It keeps that whole thing brewing and foaming, which I think probably does help Dennis Kucinich. Yeah.
You know, last week there was an NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll that showed that really this gun issue has kind of simmered since the Parkland school shooting. Back in February, 59% apparently of Democrats said that, you know, this would affect them or of Democratic voters. And then 46% are saying that now. So I don't know. You can't really – that's national. You can't really gauge where that stands. But it does seem that when there's one of these shootings, everyone comes out and starts talking gun control. Mm-hmm. And then 2, 3, 4 weeks away, the further they get away, they start, considering other factors. Mm-hmm. And it's not the litmus test issue. A lot of, you know, people for they look at a lot of things when they make their decision. And gun control might be one of them, but they might also care about the education issue and jobs and other things. So they kind of put it in perspective of the total package. And if that's the case, it kind of bodes well for Rich Cordray.
And I also think guns have always been more of a litmus issue for Republicans than for Democrats. You know,
well, I wonder
if
that isn't something that's changing, though.
It's quite possible, but at least historically, I mean, if you are pro Second Amendment, if you're pro, you know, access to firearms, that is very helpful in the Republican primary. If you're anti-gun or pro-gun control, that is less helpful in a Democratic primary.
Well, it's kind of roiled here in Ohio, too. I mean, as we sit here, we're less than, I think, 3 hours away from Governor Casey's going to sign an executive order to what he says create gun safety by increasing background checks here in Ohio. So I don't have the details. It hasn't happened yet as we do the live recording here. Mm-hmm. But so we have John Kasich, you know, pleasing a lot of the gun control advocates. So that roils this whole Republican-Democrat. Now, he's a rare Republican, of course, who is doing that.
And he's not running for anything right now.
Mm-hmm. He's not?
Well, okay.
All right.
Maybe
his name is not on the ballot.
There's always that backdrop of, he's running for president. Okay. We are going
to... I thought you had a scoop, Ann.
We're going to continue our conversation. That's Darrell Rowland, public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch, also with us. Jesse Balmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer and Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Our weekly Reporters Roundtable continues with Jesse Balmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer, Joe Ingles of Ohio Public Radio, and Darrell Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch. Let's talk Republican race for governor. Mike DeWine is definitely hitting hard at Mary Taylor. I mean, he's calling her two-faced and, you know, getting, geez, it's getting ugly. What's going on, Joe Ingles?
Well, I don't know. We don't see.
They must see some numbers that we're not seeing. Yeah.
We're not seeing those numbers, but you can only feel like maybe they're getting the sense that they need to fight back right now. You know, Mary Taylor had, you know, thrown out some stuff, too, about Mike DeWine. It's not all one-sided here. Right. And, you know, I think that he's, you know, fighting back in many ways. I think, too, and I've said it again, the absence of having a debate between those two is probably contributing to the negativity. Because they don't have another place to kind of level the complaints that they have with each other or make the differences for voters.
Well, they could.
They could if they wanted to do that. But, you know, when you're sitting on a huge stack of cash, and let's face it, Mike DeWine has plenty of cash. He doesn't have to worry about that in his campaign. So when you're sitting on that much money, sometimes it's just easier to air ads. And then that way you don't have to answer, you know, a lot of tough questions and possibly trip up in a debate or something like that.
He is sitting on a ton of cash, but I would submit that spending $1 million on this latest ad for Mary Taylor, that's still a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
That he can ill afford if he's going into a really competitive race in November, which he probably will be if he wins the nomination.
Well, and that's on top of an earlier $1 million buy, well, for a biographical ad. And I think there was a yet another negative ad that also was $1 million buy. So
right.
Even when campaign finance terms, you add up those millions, it's real money.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's,
but the PACs are going to come out. That dark money's going to come out in spades, you know, come
election
time.
Once the nomination settled,
Yeah, it's been interesting. It's actually a few weeks ago that this really started to heat up because for the longest time, Mike DeWine was largely ignoring Mary Taylor. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was at the Ohio Republican Party's endorsement when Mary Taylor was, you know, saying, oh, this is Mike DeWine's living room and we're going to have Fran DeWine's recipes later and everything like that. So she has been basically hitting him for a while, but it really wasn't until she went on television and the airwaves that Mike DeWine started spending money as well. And I guess the Mike DeWine campaign argument is, you know, you don't want your competitor on television when you aren't on television too. But it also kind of gives into this argument that it's a competitive race. If you're ignoring your candidate, then it's not competitive. Just think 2014, John Kasich, Ed Fitzgerald, you know.
Right. And I guess two things. And one, you have to look at Mike DeWine's past campaigns, I think. He is, let's just put it this way, he's been a very vigorous campaigner and not afraid to, you know, go for that the proverbial jugular vein there. Mm-hmm. Sherrod Brown, you know, back in 2006, when he ran against John Glenn.
He was really rough in that, that's
yeah.
for sure.
So this
which
is,
was to his
detriment. Yes,
when
yeah.
it came to dissing John Glenn.
Exactly, yeah. An American icon. It didn't mm-hmm. didn't work out so well. So it's not like there's not a little bit of a history here. And two, I think if you fact check the latest ad, he talks about Mary Taylor's family getting rich from the state, almost like a payoff. My colleague Randy Ludlow looked into this. This is way shorthand, but basically the state gave some grants, legitimate state contract. Mary Taylor's husband, you know, does construction stuff. He got a piece, legitimately, as far as anyone can tell, of that money. But the DeWine ad makes it sound like the state, just because she was lieutenant governor, she steered that money.
$100 million,
right into their pocket.
Yeah,
well,
right.
Yeah, and that's like the whole project. And he didn't even it's not like he had a $100 million contract. So that's kind of sloppy from a fact-checking standpoint.
I called it bologna soup.
I'm sorry?
Bologna soup.
Bologna soup.
I don't know why. It's the first time I've ever heard it. It's just garbage.
Okay. It sounds like something they make in Waldo.
It sounds horrible, doesn't it?
Nah, let's not insult the GNR
Not the bologna
sandwiches.
No, not the fried bologna in Waldo. You can't go there. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. We're talking gubernatorial politics right now. The primary is just 2 weeks away. It's getting so exciting, isn't it, Jesse Balmer?
I'm so excited, Ann. No, it does seem like it's been so long. And especially on the Democratic side, just the number of people who have come. come and gone. And I had like a post-it note on my desk of like who was running, and I had to keep ripping it up and replacing it. Yeah. I think Joe Schiavone is the only one of like the original people who are running on the Democratic side that's still in it.
Now we have Bill O'Neill, former Supreme Court Justice. We have Richard Cordray.
And Dennis Kucinich. But obviously we
know. There's three others that no one ever talks about because they
also,
don't campaign.
That's right.
Larry Ely and Paul Ray, right?
John Ray. Was it John Ray? Paul Ray?
Remember. So clearly a big factor in that race. And then obviously on the Republican side, Jim Renacci went over to run for the the U.S. Senate race and so forth. So we've had it's been a large mashup of people. But here we are at the end with two Republicans and several Democrats. And we'll see who actually, you know, gets across the finish line.
The one thing I wondered if. Was whether or not if the DeWine Taylor race does come out close either way, does a close race and whoever wins that race weaker or stronger in the general? Thoughts?
I'm going to say stronger.
Okay.
And let me give you a reason why. When President Trump was running for office, a lot of people were Kasich fans. And Ohio actually went for Kasich. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were very, you know, John Kasich kind of took a lot of hits from President Trump or then candidate Trump. And a lot of people didn't like that. There was a negativity toward that. But once Trump was declared the nominee, it seemed like all of the Republicans who were out there who had been, you know, campaigning against Trump and so, held their voices very high on that issue. All of them went to him, except for Kasich, you know. But all of them kind of went there, got behind him. And that's kind of what, if you look at the history of Republican races, that's kind of what happens in the Republican Party. You know, they might fight among themselves, but at the end of the day, when the nominee's named, most of them will go there. It's not like the Democratic Party, when you looked at the Bernie factor in the race, and there was much more animosity and lack of, you know, a lot of people didn't go vote.
That just seemed to me like a function of how many young voters were going for for Bernie. I think, and they were on, they don't have that hardcore party loyalty that, say, people that came up through unions and that kind of a thing might feel toward the Democratic Party.
I think if DeWine wins, you know, it's a win and, you know, everything is smooth. If Mary Taylor somehow pulls off the upset, that is going to bring about an incredible dynamic because she has, you know, burnt every bridge she's had with the Ohio Republican Party.
How are they going to turn around and support her?
Well, there's one thing. Obviously, they're going to pick her over whomever the Republican or the Democratic nominee is. But how enthusiastic? I mean, when you've been ripped and eviscerated, as I was at that endorsement meeting alongside Jesse and other Ohio reporters. I mean, it was right in your face, to their face, of the top Republicans in this state. You know, this is rigged. I really don't even want your endorsement anymore. And and the way she's campaigned since that. And so, well, if she wins the nomination, will she get that enthusiasm down through the ranks where people are going to put their yard signs in, make the phone banks, do the phone calls and all that you need to build a healthy campaign? So, again, the Republican Party, of course, is going to endorse whoever wins the Republican primary. But how enthusiastic and how much real support is there going to be?
I don't know. We saw it in the presidential last time around, and it seemed like there was quite a bit of support in the end.
I'd say I lean more towards Republicans uniting behind the nominee just because,
whoever.
I mean, President Donald Trump was then candidate. Donald Trump was, you know, he was not very nice to the Ohio Republican Party or its chairman, Matt Borges, who he still brings up. So I think ORP will get behind their candidate.
Yeah, the party's pretty much disintegrated and reassembled under a new leadership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure it will be an easier transition for at least the Ohio Republican Party if Mike DeWine is the candidate. But I'm sure they'll get behind him behind Mary Taylor rather than Rich Cordray or Dennis Kucinich or whoever else the Democrats pick.
The correct thing that the Trump people picked, the Ohio Trump people predicted in 2016 was that once it became a binary choice, once you had this Trump guy, whom everyone seemingly disparaged, but against Hillary, whom everyone seemed to hate, and again, I'm exaggerating for effect here, the choice was easy for most Ohioans. You know, I'm going to hold my nose and vote for Trump. I don't think, unless it's Kucinich who comes out of that Democratic primary, even so, there's just not that visceral negative former Secretary Clinton had, former Senator Clinton had in 2016. Rich Cordray, it's like you can hate his policies, but hating him personally is going to be a lift for a lot of Ohioans, I think.
But he's had President Obama and Senator Warren. Mm-hmm. And they've been supporting him thus far. And I can only imagine that coming down to the general, that they'll be here again or they'll be in some way supporting him. And a lot of the Republicans still to this day talk about Obama being a problem. And, you know, so that may be.
But he won Ohio twice.
Well, he did. He did. So. He won Ohio twice.
The Ohio Secretary of State's office is reporting some early trends right now. One, that Democrats are asking for more ballots for the primary. 25,000 more Democrats have asked early ballots. And I was wondering is that a true indicator of enthusiasm? Are you expecting a more enthusiastic turnout at the polls than maybe we're accustomed to?
I mean, I think there is some enthusiasm from Democrats. That's certainly something both Democrats and Republicans will tell you. But one of the numbers that actually surprised me was fewer people had returned their ballots, like had actually cast their ballots, than in 2014 when the race was pretty decided on both sides. So a lot more people have asked for ballots, but they haven't filled them out yet. So maybe that's an indication of indecision so far. But
well, yeah, there's actually decisions to make this year, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, historically, and I mean historically, we're talking about a decade or so in Ohio, Democrats have always been the early voters, especially early in-person voting, where you go to the Board of Elections, during the day or in those limited weekend hours and cast a vote, early vote in person. So And on election night, this is a general election, almost always those first returns, if it's a close race at all, Democrats are going to be ahead. It's going to be, and then the Republicans turn out more on election day. At least that's what we've seen. Mm-hmm. But again, there's lots of dynamics here. And you mentioned the young voters, the anti-gun crowd. How many even registered to vote? How many are going to show up at the polls? That's going to be one of the key questions throughout the year, not just the primary.
The registration's closed now.
Right. For the primary, right.
Is there any numbers in that are interesting there?
You can't get, as far as age breakdown quite this quickly.
Okay.
It might be interesting because you were able to register online for the first time, so that might help numbers as far as registration goes. But I haven't seen the results.
It'll be interesting to see if that younger contingent shows up. We will continue our conversation. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is our weekly reporter roundtable. With me in the studio, Jesse Balmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer, Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, and Joe Engels of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Coming up, we're going to be talking about that payday lending issue at the Statehouse, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Again, still with us, Jesse Balmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer, Joe Engels of Ohio Public Radio, and Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch. All right, so let's talk about the payday lending issue. After sitting dormant pretty much on ice for 58 weeks, I learned from Tom Suttis' column in the Dispatch this Sunday. A bill to crack down on extremely high interest rates charged by payday lenders suddenly is moving forward at the Statehouse. The bill closes loopholes in the 2008 law that was supposed to cap interest rates at 28%. The only action it saw in recent months was attempts to weaken it. A citizen group began collecting signatures to put it on the ballot. Then came word that the FBI was asking questions about Speaker of the House Cliff Rosenberger's foreign travel with payday lender lobbyists. The Speaker, at first said he was going to hold off until May or something to resign, which in and of itself is quick, is a fast exit. But then he quit even sooner than that. And now the bill was suddenly voted out of committee completely unscathed. It's an amazing thing with a few FBI questions, sudden resignation of the House Speaker. You know, it's just kind of an amazing time in the Ohio General Assembly. What do you think, Darryl Roland?
Yeah, I think we can credit that to the FBI.
But they've not neither confirmed nor denied, right?
Oh, no. But those three letters just stoke fear throughout the state.
Cliff Rosenberger said it, so.
Yeah, exactly. A week prior to this surprise vote was another kind of surprise vote. Same backdrop. I mean, we knew what we knew about a supposed FBI investigation. You know, it was known then as much as we know now, and that's about the 100% of it right there. But the committee would not even accept the bill, not just vote on it. You know, there's that kind of arcane process. We'll accept this bill, and then we'll talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't even do that. Then a week later, we now don't accept the bill. We vote for the bill. And all these amendments that would eviscerate it or even weaken it a little bit, we're not even going to do that. We're going to pass it out. And in fact, Kirk Schering, the interim speaker, says, you know, we're going to pass this through the House. And the leaders of the Senate said, looks good to us, too. So we went from hold up to looks like it's a done deal. Wow. You know, the FBI has the grease, don't they?
They must have something.
Yeah, you have to wonder what they have on Rosenberger and how deep this goes. Because
how deep this goes is what I'm wondering now.
Because, you know, this thing, to vote it out like that, they're trying to send a strong message that, hey, we're not in the pocket of payday lenders.
But methinks thou dost protest too much. Maybe it went too fast.
I think House Republicans who are trying to distance themselves from this FBI inquiry and the former speaker could not be too happy to send this bill over to the Senate. So I think the people who are in charge, Kirk Schering, who was Rosenberger's number two, and then also Ryan Smith, who wants to be a successor to Cliff Rosenberger, is on this committee. And so I think there are just too many people in this room that would rather not be dealing with this right now.
Right.
And we should, you know, remind listeners, what is the connection between the payday lenders and the FBI? Is, you know, Speaker Rosenberger said the FBI is asking questions, so I'm retaining your criminal attorney. And it quickly became apparent that one of the things that they were, well, again, I'll say apparently, were inquiring about was this trip funded by payday lenders, which Speaker Rosenberger and another Ohio rep, and frankly, lawmakers in other states, took to England, lavish spending there, nice accommodations and all that. So it's like, so you talk about pay to play. So you would say that's the pay. Then the play is, okay, payday lenders, that was a nice trip. So this bill you hate, we'll just bottle it up as long as we can.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the equation that's being done, the math, if you will, the political math at the State House. And as you know, Joe and Jesse both said, Republicans say, no, we don't want to make that up. One and one doesn't make two necessarily here. So see FBI, we'll crack down those bad payday lenders. They can't buy us off. And we will see.
Hmm. What will we see? I mean, so they get it all the way through, but what would one be looking for? If it involves other people, campaign contributions, other trips with other lawmakers.
Sure. Keep going. And that's the thing. It's like what has happened now.
Yeah.
And whatever evidence the FBI has gathered, again, they have their public integrity mm-hmm. unit here. They've had it for about a decade or so. These are unlike the FBI under, I think, and on a previous show, we talked about under the Larry Householder days, mm-hmm. some people, frankly, lament that the FBI stubbed its toe because they didn't have necessarily the political crime experts, if you will, like they do now. And if you look at the track record of other legislators they've taken down, they have tapes, recordings, videotapes in some kind. They don't just – it's not just a he said, she said. Mm-hmm. If they're going to take somebody down – and again, Ohio State, we don't know this. Mr. Rosenberger is entitled to his presumption of innocence. Mm-hmm. But if they're going to take somebody down, they usually have a briefcase full of stuff. And we should add to this discussion now over the weekend, you know, interesting, the legislature is pretty much as mystified as we are in this room and everyone listening to this is, what is really going on here?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So David Leland and Kristen Boggs, two Columbus Democratic state reps, put in a request for an investigation with Tony Bledsoe, the legislative inspector general, Ron O'Brien, the Franklin County prosecutor, say, look, we've got this out there. All we know is that the Speaker of the House has resigned, you know, I guess you could say in disgrace, under the cloud of an investigation. And they're saying this is the first time in Ohio history. I haven't looked back in the 1820s to see anything, but, you know, it is thought to be the first time in Ohio history something like this is happening. So they're saying, get to the bottom of this. Ohio people
well,
need
Vern
to know.
Wright was
Our
investigated
voters need
for
to know.
The pancaking scandal back in the 90s, but he wasn't, it wasn't an FBI.
He didn't, well,
and
he didn't resign.
He didn't resign, right.
He didn't resign.
Right.
Right. Well, obviously, as we spoke, Speaker Householder was investigated, you know, and he left office.
He wasn't found guilty of anything, but
he was not.
He was not charged.
He
I don't believe.
Charged. I'm sorry, he was not charged. Apology. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I meant.
But you know, the politics of this are at play here. I mean, I think that's the bigger issue here. This is coming out just before the primary,
yeah.
And so all of the you know that big briefcase the FBI has, that's going to be opened going into the fall. It's already thought that this November, we've heard a lot of political analysts say it's going to be a blue year. We've seen other states where Democratic candidates have done better than expected in you know, the primaries we've seen already this year. And so if it is, you know, predicted to be a blue year, and if there is all of this FBI stuff coming out and the Republicans are being investigated, they have to be pretty apprehensive in a way about that, and they probably want to send a very strong message that, you know, hey, we're not in anyone's pocket, despite what this investigation might say.
And obviously, this is the most prominent politician who's been affected by, you know, this cloud recently. But there have also been Republican lawmakers who've had to resign, Senator Cliff Height, because of allegations of sexual harassment that were pretty well reported, and then also Representative Wes Goodman had to resign after, you know,
out of Dayton,
more like Marysville, Marion area.
Oh, okay.
There have been a couple lawmakers who, shortly after sensitivity training, made some off-color and inappropriate remarks. So there's been a number of issues with Republican lawmakers recently that I am certain Democratic candidates are going to bring up in their primaries. Yeah, there's that whole mess out of Dayton. With the primary candidates kind of going head-to-head over allegations of sexting and inappropriate behavior there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm mixing up my locales, but yeah. It's the same story.
Well, it's almost when you start dating a scorecard, you know, yeah. This is when sometimes it takes a while for this stuff to get through the voters. You remember in 2006, we look back at it now and talk about the culture of corruption, CoinGate, and all that stuff.
Yep.
Well, you know, early in that election year, all that stuff wasn't necessarily apparent that it would all come together and affect the election so much. Certainly the prospect was there.
Mm-hmm.
So Democrats, you know, they would love to see 2006 all over again. Republicans, they can remember, you know, just 12 years ago. They do want to do their darndest to, you know, keep out of that sling. So that's, as Joe said, the political backdrop, I guess, this is fascinating. And the word that's kind of struck fear through me, though, was former Speaker Rosenberger said when he retained his attorney that the FBI investigation could take months or even years. You know, what I think all the voters hope and pray that this gets resolved one way or another well before the fall election. I mean, you don't want something the week before the election either. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd hope, you know, by Labor Day or something like that. Hello, FBI. You need to be done by Labor Day. Okay. The Ann Fisher Show has told you. So.
Yes.
but, you know, just because I think, you know, that cloud is out there. And if it's unfairly out there, you know, Republicans deserve to be cleared as well.
Right. Right. And the other thing is, if you look at the Republican Party, especially since Donald Trump has become president, you have the sort of an internal struggle between the more moderate members of the party and the conservative members of the party. And the numbers have really shown that a lot of Republicans who are in that moderate, they're resigning. They're resigning from Congress. They're giving up control. Now, how does that plays okay right now? Because we're not in a general election. Mm-hmm. But when you go into a general election, how's that going to play? Is that going to drive people over to the Democrats? Or are people just going to become more conservative and go with the more conservative choices?
But how much choice, given gerrymandering, do people really have? I mean, there's a few seats that are in play. Maybe even the one to replace T-Berry might be in play more. It's more of a suburban seat that might have a little more wishy-washiness to it that it might not have had six, even 8 years ago.
Right. Steve Chabot's seat down in Cincinnati, because, that a lot of that district has gotten a lot more blue, and they have, Jesse, I'm sure, knows more about this. There's a really good Democrat candidate running against him. Maybe even in the 16th, where is Jim Renacci, the seat he's giving up. There's a very bitter Republican primary there, but there's some strong Democrats there. And Bob Gibbs, the sitting incumbent in his district, the Democrat has outraised him, which is very rare, the last couple of cycles. Mm-hmm. So there is some foment out there, even with the map tilted. So that's the thing. If it's a wave year, how high will that wave wash? Mm-hmm. I mean, when you talk about possibly like a Pat T-Berry district or Jim Renacci's district, if they're in play, I mean, that means Democrats have got to be feeling really good about what's going to be happening nationwide.
I think that being said, but at least in the Ohio legislature, I think only 9 out of the 33 Senate seats are held by Democrats, and the Republicans also have a supermajority in the Ohio House. And so I guess I'd be surprised if the wave is high enough for them to retake either of those.
But they could pair the majority. It won't be could be not supermajority.
I think it's likely that Republicans will lose the supermajority, but I would be super surprised if they lost the majority.
Yeah, I would too.
And that's key. If they lose their veto-proof majority in either chamber, if there's a Democrat elected governor, then
they have
veto
a chance to do something.
Yeah, or at least to prevent things from being done.
Right, right. And speaking of things getting done, back to that payday lending measure, activists are not taking any chances. They're still putting an issue on the ballot. What about that? I mean,
I think that the activists have learned, they're doing the same thing. If you look at the redistricting issue, the backers of redistricting are still, even though the people who have the petition to put redistricting on the ballot have pretty much said, we like this proposal that you're going to see in May, vote for it. A lot of them have gone that way. But even with that being said, they're still collecting the signatures to have a backup in November if they want. And I think the payday lenders, the people who are going after the payday lenders, are doing the same thing, because it's kind of an insurance plan. And they already have so many of the signatures they need. I mean, if you look at it, what do they stand to lose?
I think Ohio voters have learned recently from marijuana, from redistricting, from payday lending, that if they can provide a little pressure on lawmakers that, hey, if you don't pass the bill that you're working on, we got something else, and maybe you don't like that as much as what you're working on. I think that has been instrumental in legislation in recent years.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jesse makes an excellent point. And, we saw that back in, 2006 with the what was called the Ron Amendments, Reform Ohio Now.
Uh-huh.
Some of those were co-opted by the legislature. That's why we have early voting. That's why you can vote now, folks, essentially, was a ballot issue was put on. It was defeated, but the legislature tried to preempt that ballot issue and indeed preempted it, enacted a less restrictive early voting here in Ohio, and campaign finance reform.
So the payday lending measure, though, it'll get approved by the House. And then the Senate said, hey, looks good to us, too, now. And the governor, has he signed? I know he doesn't usually say in advance, but any sense from the governor's office?
I know we'll be asking about that, but I don't think we have an answer at this point.
Okay. No comment. Gun restrictions, gun rights rally over the weekend. A couple hundred people showed up for that. The state's already made it impossible for cities and towns to approve their own gun restrictions through a Cleveland case. What's different about this provision now?
Well, this provision would go a little further in that there's some wiggle room that the cities have found in the current language, and they've been able to do some smaller things on the margins to restrict guns and to make more rules on who can have guns and in what kind of circumstances. So this bill that's going through the legislature would kind of close those loopholes and make it so it's harder for cities and, you know, harder for people to go through that back door, if you will. And it would also change it also holds cities accountable. So if they put some kind of restriction in place and they are able to keep it and someone is injured and can prove in court that they're injured because of that restriction, then they can get damages on that bill that you're talking about.
And that's why it's an interesting dynamic as the legislature. And that's part of the so-called Stand Your Ground bill, which is just loaded up with all sorts of gun rights amendments. Now Governor Kasich is coming out and doing something on background checks by executive order.
Oh, really?
Not even attempting to do anything through the legislature. So we'll see how that goes over with his fellow Republicans.
Yeah, and I believe the thing that he's looking at today is addressing an issue that my colleague and I reported on pretty extensively, which is clerks of courts and sheriffs are supposed to report the people who are like convicted or indicted and not allowed to have a gun. They send that up to the background check list, but sometimes that is not done comprehensively. We saw some audits where people had left these records in a drawer or said, oh, I'm too busy to send those. And the effect of that is if someone who shouldn't have a gun goes to buy a gun and he or she would pass a background check because the record system isn't up to date. And so I think this is something that a lot of people have said, yeah, if we could shore that up, that would be better for Ohio. I'm not sure the specifics of how the governor's executive order would address that or how it would be different from the bill that Republicans introduced to address some of these things.
You know, the home rule issue in Ohio is very messed up right now. It's unclear.
That's one way to say it.
We only have about a minute left. But, you know, I grew up covering the legislature and home rule was king, you know, in Ohio. And now Republican lawmakers who were always the big backers of home rule are the ones that have undone it so much. And you do wonder, I mean, Cleveland's not the same as Belle Fountain. Why shouldn't there be different laws in different cities?
Well, you get to arguing about uniformity. I mean,
everyone's all mixed
can
up.
Am I allowed to do one thing with my gun here, but I cross the city limit and now that's not allowed? And it involves, you know, the gun rights argument. It restricts a constitutional right.
But it's everything. I mean, you know, you look at the pet stores. Pet stores cannot be regulated by cities as far as, you know, the cracking down on puppy mills, that sort of thing. I mean, there's all kinds of local government regulations that have been kind of put off by the legislature in the past few years in new bills that have come out and been signed.
As well as cutting local government funding.
Exactly.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And part of the confusion there. And part of the confusion is we like home rule sometimes and we hate home rule other times. So if you're looking for some consistency across legislation, there really hasn't been in recent years.
Yeah, home rule's cool until it's not.
Voters, too bad for you. Beware. Something. Jesse Ballmer of the Cincinnati Inquirer, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks to you as well.
Good times, Ann.
And Joe Ingles. Sorry, it started with a J.
It does.
Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks to you as
Always
well.
Always great to
appreciate
be here.
It. That's it for our weekly Reporters Roundtable on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thanks so much for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.